What we agreed to speak about this evening is the problem of people becoming involved in a more Jewish way of life, more, let's say, Orthodox way of life, and coming into conflict with people with whom they class, family, husband and wife, parents and children. That's the problem. It's a very big problem. It can tear families apart. Usually there is a phase when someone gets involved that the family does get turned upside down. And perhaps we can alleviate it to some extent by this discussion. We'll discuss mainly the problem of a younger person getting involved and coming into conflict with parents. That's the classical situation. But it applies, much of what we'll say applies to a husband or wife becoming involved where the other party is not growing at the same rate in Yiddishkeit, and that often causes a tremendous marital problem. A deep marital problem, both emotionally, intimately, because of the menstrual separation laws, that becomes a point of conflict, and it's a dynamite situation. What I think we should do, with your permission, is make this a discussion. To hear what I think is important or interesting about it might not be what you would like to hear. And therefore, what I propose to do is to give you an introduction which amounts to the way I see the problem, and then if you have questions, I would ask you to ask them. If you don't feel like asking a question personally, write it on a scrap of paper, allegedly and very briefly, and send it up, and that way we will be dealing anonymously with certain problems. Very seldom nervous when I give a share. But that's because I'm usually preaching to the converted. It's not so difficult. They make allowances for you. But whom I hope is here tonight, I don't know many of you, I hope who've come tonight are the people who are experiencing some of the problems, and I don't expect you to see things my way. And therefore, what I'd like to set out as a goal for this evening's discussion is not that you should end up seeing things my way, or the way of any younger person who's become involved. What I'd like to make clear is that I think the best we can achieve is that you could at least gain an insight into seeing the way that other people do see it. You don't have to see it that way, and I don't expect you to see it that way. I don't expect you to change your view of life, and it doesn't happen to a person in an hour. It took me many years, my own personal experience, to become fully committed to this way of life after having started out normal. If we don't put some humor into this, we're just not going to survive it. But what I hope to achieve is that you'll gain an insight into the way somebody with whom you're dealing sees this problem, right? The way he sees life. It might make it a lot easier to relate to such an individual, even though you yourself might maintain and retain very strictly and strongly differing views from that particular individual. But it makes it tremendously easier if you have an insight into, and you usually can't hear it from them. Even if I tell you tonight the same things that the youngster in the home may be telling you, it's very difficult to hear instruction about what life really should be from someone whose nappies you changed when they were small. At least I'm somebody objective to you outside, and therefore it may be easier to hear. Finally, by way of introduction, I'd like to say that I'm probably the world's expert or one of the world's leading authorities on the subject. I've been through it myself, although I must say I didn't have many of the problems that I wish to discuss with you. My family simply thought I was nuts, but they didn't cause any problems. As it happens, they themselves ended up seeing things my way. I assure you, through no fault of mine, it wasn't my influence. But I didn't suffer that particular problem, and I haven't suffered personally from a number of the problems that we'll discuss. But I have come into contact with them many times in the course of the number of years that I've been involved dealing with young people and also with marriages, both on a medical basis, people have approached me, and both on a Torah basis, for what it's worth, and I've come into contact with, I think, pretty much most of the problems that people experience in this area. Let me tell you the following thing. I'll start off with a few minutes, just a very brief synopsis of how I personally became involved. I think it's relevant, and I think it will give you a model, perhaps, for what a person goes through and what it is that attracts a person into this way of life. Why I think it's necessary is because I don't know you personally, but there are many people who feel antagonistic to a youngster becoming involved who feel so very, very strongly, to the point that they cannot be objective anymore. There are homes in which parents have had a child, attempted to have a child committed as insane because he got involved in a religious way of life. there is a group in Israel, a parents' support group, that gets together to commiserate with each other and even take legal action against the people whom they feel are the brainwashers or the instigators who get their children involved in yeshiva way of life. They have stooped to violent action. There are a number of young Israelis who have been sent for observation in mental homes because the parents felt, in many cases I'll admit to you, that it's because the person had an extreme tendency in their personality, and this was just a way of its being expressed. That happens too. You can be an unobjective groupie in Torah or in Yiddishkeit just as you can in something that's not valid. There's no question about that. And it might even be fitting at this point to say that very often it's the youngster or the person getting involved who's responsible for most of the conflict. Very often. And I'll try and share that idea with you in detail also. But you have a lot of strong antagonism. And the conventional stereotype is that the youngster became involved because somebody got hold of him and brainwashed him, or because he's weak-willed and doesn't think about things, or for some other nonsensical reason. Usually it's not that way. Very briefly, the way I personally became involved to this extent that I am, very briefly, just so you know where I'm coming from, in 2 minutes, was as follows. I started out from my mother's here, it's going to be hard. I started out from a home that, while it was very special, didn't... was not any more deeply Torah knowledgeable or observant than the average or many other South African homes. I had in my background very much a Torah tradition. My grandfather was a great Eloi, a great genius in Talmudic learning and in personality. He was a genius in his personality, in his self-development. He was an example to hundreds, maybe thousands of people. And so the family had a very deep, they were machshiv, they understood very much what Torah was, and I was brought up with a tremendous respect for that. But to know what it was inside, to have studied what Talmud was, to know what Torah learning is inside, or what deep, committed Torah observance is, I didn't know. I went to King David Victory Park, where we didn't have a Jewish education in the Torah sense, in the Orthodox sense. We had a very Jewish education. We were very Jewish conscious and so forth, but we never had a shas in the school, a set of volumes of the Talmud we never had. What that was, I was not exposed to. So that's my particular personal background. I didn't come from a negative background. I came from a positive background, but I didn't have the personal experience. And I grew up very much like most of my contemporaries, very much oriented towards the physical existence. Not going to go into details, but although I retained always an interest in the more spiritual side of things, especially the human side, I went to medical school, I studied medicine as part of an interest in what I felt was my personal capabilities in life, dealing with people in some way or other, and it was, generally speaking, during the medical school years that I got involved in this way of life. And if you really want a more organized appraisal of a description of what it was, you can read a book. There's a book called Anatomy of a Search, which came out a couple of years ago, which describes the pathway of a number of people, including myself, who got involved. The first chapter is a story of my own development, how I personally ended up in yeshiva in Jerusalem after being an average type of South African boy. The last chapter, although it's not under my name, is also my personal story. I just felt it was too much to make one lengthy, such a long chapter. The other chapters you'll find cover a friend of mine who was an Israeli fighter pilot who was my neighbor, who ended up in yeshiva also. Half the stories in the book are South Africans. There's a chapter dealing with a women's experience, closely connected with my wife's experience and certain friends of hers. And about half the people are South Africans and the other half are Israelis or American. And it describes how these individuals found their way into an Orthodox, intense Torah learning situation from very much a different background. And it's much more organized over there, and I try to put between the lines in that book a lot of the depth of understanding of what makes a person become attracted to such a course. But basically what happened was that after matric, I felt the need, somehow, no real explanation for it, to know a bit more about my Jewish sort of background and the depth of it. And I wanted to study more, and I did start studying more, although it involved no change of observance or behavior. And basically at medical school I became much more involved. The main reason was there were people who used to come to campus, medical school campus and also varsity campus, who gave shirim dealing with the basics of Judaism from an aspect and angle I'd never seen before, not a depth that I'd never experienced before. It was accentuated during my third year at medical school, which is a particularly non-human oriented year. You do pathology and microbiology, the kind of subjects that aren't immediately people oriented. They're not yet the clinical years. And I was under pressure. It's a lot of work that one has to do. And I felt the need to express myself in some other way. And I also felt the need, if you want to know, I'll tell you the honest truth. It started with a specific decision that I needed a day off to really be with myself, with my family, commune with myself, and not get hung up in the paraphernalia of society, getting hassled by the traffic and by the media. I wanted a day just to myself. It wasn't really a religious motivation. I thought it was a practical idea. And it seemed to me that Shabbos was that kind of an idea. And so I went to the local rabbi of my shul, and I asked him exactly what I had to do, although I had a vague idea. And I was tremendously impressed by the fact that he told me, the first thing he told me was to slow down and not to take on all the details. I was amazed by that. One of the most powerful experiences I had. And I'm trying to include things that I hope you'll take to heart. Because the tendency of a person getting involved is to absolutely overdo it. And what happens is they start putting emphasis on unnecessary detail and driving the family crazy when it's completely unnecessary. And it's the unbalance that this leads to, which I wish to speak about later also, is that a young person starts, while his mother's got guests and she serves a meal that she's really torn her hair out to get right for him. In front of all the guests, he picks up the lettuce and he starts checking the lettuce in the light to see if his mother didn't notice, that's not the way to behave. Because in doing that, while you might enact a detail of the laws of kashrus, you blatantly stamp and trample on the Torah mitzvah of honoring your parents and many others along the way also. And that's the thing that takes a lot of skill to achieve a balance in, and that's what we'll try and talk about later. But anyway, I decided that I needed Shabbos, and he told me to take it easy, do the essentials, get the priorities straight, and I started doing that. My father, Allah Mashal, who was alive at the time, was very much behind me, and he started, my parents were in general, my whole family, but he specifically used to sit with me on Shabbos and made me take it very seriously. I just wanted a day off, basically. But he made me study, learn the Sedra with him. We used to go through it in detail, took hours that we studied together, and he himself became involved that way also. A busy medical specialist, he found the time, he got involved, he became observant in his own right, he used to phone me in Israel with questions. That's another story. Just to show you that somebody in his 70s can become as enthused and become and change his way of life just as dramatically as a youngster who doesn't have a settled outlook on life. It's very important for you to note that. There are many families in which that's happened. Not saying the rest of my family didn't. I'm just using that as his particular experience as an example. Shabbos turned out to be an amazing experience. Being disconnected from the hassle and bustle of the world was an amazing experience, I have to tell you. It got my mind organized. When the week had got me down, Shabbos, even though I wasn't into it spiritually, didn't have any spiritual aspiration, I just wanted a day off that I could time out, sort of get myself settled, it had a tremendous effect on me. And one by one, other things started to happen. I started attending more shirim. I found eventually I couldn't eat meat out that wasn't kosher. Eventually I wasn't able to eat out at all, even though I never made conscious decisions. One thing led to another. But the most important thing that I wish to share with you was that the thing that impressed me and drew me in more than anything else was not the things that I learned, it was the people who said the things. When I went to shirim and I heard people say ideas, even if the ideas were strange to me, even if I didn't see how they were necessarily relevant immediately, I was overwhelmingly impressed by the personality of the people who gave the shirim. They were not groupies who were hypnotized or brainwashed into what they were saying. They were amazingly rational, critical thinking individuals whose intellectual power and originality, despite the stereotype of the religious world being a uniformed type of world where everybody thinks and does the same, the sparkle of their originality, the depth of their analytical power. Again, I don't hope to convince you of this. You would only be able to experience it yourself if you tried. I'm just sharing with you again, let me emphasize, I'm not trying to change your mind. I'm just trying to show you the way I see it, or the way we or other people involved see it. Not that you have to think this way. That's my response. Whether it's true or not, it's up to you to decide. You can't decide without experiencing it. But you can at least acknowledge that that's the way I read the situation. And I experienced people who were outstanding in their intellectual capacities, in their personal integrity, in their dignity, in the quality of their lives. And I was tremendously impressed. I then started visiting these people who used to go for Shabbos, and I was overwhelmed almost to tears, and in fact to tears on more than one occasion, by the warmth and the spirit and the amazing atmosphere in a Jewish home on Shabbos. Instead of being a home where my contemporaries were using Shabbos to escape or to run out, or there was a lucky if you crossed paths somewhere in the family, it was an experience where the pleasure of the family was just being together. That's very unusual to find a home where that exists today. There's such a gap and misunderstanding between the generations that it's very unusual to find that. And here was a family where there was no gap, where the warmth of Shabbos, the warmth of the whole drive, Everything that people were experiencing was simply enjoying each other and being together. Amazing experience. The music, the singing, the Shabbos meals. It's been said that what influences a young person to get involved more than the philosophical ideas he hears is the taste of the cholent and the Shabbos colors that are home-baked by the woman of the house. It does more. I know a home where the rabbi is very powerful intellectually, and his wife always teases him that it's her colors that do more to influence people than his shirim. And it's true, I want to tell you. That's a fact. That's a fact. But it's an amazing experience if you've ever experienced such a thing. And when you're aware that that's coming from people who are not brainwashed individuals who are following blindly, but they're people who are tremendously critical thinkers and can analyze any idea from a secular or religious world in a very, very capable way, the people that the leaders of this way of life, then it becomes very impressive thing. And I had to admit that the outside world was in pretty much a shambles in terms of dignity, in terms of self-respect, in terms of commitment to your word, and many other things. And here was a world where people took that for granted, and I was very impressed. And as I got to know it more, I became more and more impressed, and eventually I got more and more involved. I made mistakes, the same as many do. I got too involved too early. I started doing things I wasn't ready for, and 3 weeks afterwards dropped them because it was artificial. Many people experienced that, and I'll try and share with you some of these experiences as well. Eventually it got to the point where, having qualified and done my internship, my wife and I decided, we had both become involved independently, although we knew each other, and then after becoming married had both grown together. We both decided that if we were going to take this thing seriously, we had to go and experience it the way it really is, go to Jerusalem, study in a yeshiva full time, intensely, and give ourselves a chance of experiencing that world, else we wouldn't be complete. And we tried that. We went. Initially I was amazing things happened in Israel. I'm not going to spend the whole evening on my personal story. I worked as a doctor in a very interesting medical environment at the same time as learning half day in yeshiva. Eventually it got to the point where I had to give up the medical work because I needed the full time experience. I went to yeshiva, which was very demanding. You had to learn full time in order to just keep abreast with the people. That's another experience I have to share with you, which is that in all my yeshiva experience, it's a hard thing to convey to you, intellectually it was the most humbling experience I've ever had. I was always capable in what I did. I'm not saying I was the brightest or best, but I certainly was capable in whatever context I was put in. At school or at medical school, I had no trouble. When I was put into the yeshiva world, I struggled desperately to stay with the middle of the pack. And the best I ever achieved in the yeshiva world, I'll tell you honestly, was holding somewhere about the middle of the pack and out of sight of the best. Because the Talmudic, what's required intellectually, the dedication, the memory, the intellectual faculties, the raw honesty that's required in terms of intellectual capability, many other things that it takes to be successful in the depth of Torah learning, are very, very demanding. Very demanding. It was a very humbling experience. Talk more about that later this time. And that's basically my story. I ended up spending 8 or 9, whatever, years in Yerushalayim. Eventually began teaching in Or Samach, developed an interest for the more philosophical, some people say mystical side. Happens to be something that I think is important for you to know, because this generation has that bent. And eventually discovered my own sort of personality in that and became involved in a more sort of responsible or teaching position. And the last 2 years have been doing that here. That's in a nutshell what happened to me. Now, what I would like to tell you about, I hope you're formulating your questions, okay, and you're writing them down on a scrap of paper while I'm talking. What I'd like to share with you is the way I see the situation and the background to what I see as the conflict. Again, it's personal, you don't have to accept my point of view, just telling you a very personal individual's way of looking at things. I believe it's valid for many others other than myself as well. I'm not saying it's true, the way we perceive things, the way I perceive things, but I think it's important for you to know that. I'll tell you the way I see the background to this thing, and I'm going to emphasize one detail because I think it's the crux of it's the core of why the older generation cannot understand the younger generation. Why, when there's conflict in a family and the parents think that the child is doing something that's extreme and unnecessary and destructive and they're not going to be able to earn a living and all the other things that they say, there's one underlying cause I believe that sets the tone and defines, sets up the why this thing happens. And I'll, in a few minutes, try and convey it to you. You'll see a remarkable thing come out of the discussion. You'll see that it will come out from what I'm saying, and I hope you take this point very, very clearly, that the older generation, you will see, have everything. The older generation, those who are not Torah observant and don't know what Torah learning is, in terms of personality and what it means to be a mensch, they have everything. And it's the young generation that has nothing, empty individuals, who therefore cling and therefore move into this world. Right? We need it. That generation, to a certain extent, may not have needed it. And I'll try and describe this and explain this to you, but it results in a tremendous conflict that they can't understand each other. The way I see it is as follows. Very briefly, until the 1950s, the world was basically normal. Until the 1950s, the world was basically a Torah-oriented world, Jewish and non-Jewish, generally speaking, at least in its external observance of the norms of society. That means there was such a thing as right and wrong, there was such a thing as morality, you were expected to subscribe to the concept of a right and wrong of morality, there was a sense of human dignity, people were clean-cut, their image was clean-cut, people had a sense of dress, people dressed up to go out, which is a sign of honor, people's self-worth and self-dignity, a man's word was his bond. That was the way the world was. There was a concept of patriotism. There were normal, decent, strong human values. That's the way the world was set up. Yeah? Stay with me carefully. You'll see how important it is. I'm making massive generalizations. I know. Again, I'm just trying to convey to you the image, the view, the vision that this generation has of the world. The 1960s were a time when the world exploded. Right? The world became abnormal. The world became abnormal. The youth in that generation became abnormal. From the 1970s on, the abnormality became normal. Okay? Stay with me carefully. In the 1960s, you had people rebelling. The university age, right, the young adult age group was rebelling. But they knew they were rebelling. And when they did things, they knew they were doing it against what the norms were. And that was the thrill of the experience. And it was still possible to speak to those people. Because although, are you with me? Although they themselves might have chosen to rebel, and they chose this as a breakaway, as a way of life, but they still understood what the parents were saying. Because they understood what it was they were rebelling against. But from the 1970s on, certainly the 1980s, that breakaway, that different world, which doesn't involve anymore the concepts of dignity and self-worth and clothing being an expression of your inner dignity and all these other things which I'll try and draw for you more clearly, that became the norm to the extent, in other words, we're talking about a generation that grew up since then. They didn't experience the breakaway. There weren't people rebelling against the 1950s type patriotic stand up for the anthem, salute the flag kind of generation. They were people who had... This generation of youth, who are now becoming involved in Judaism and unfortunately many other things too, this generation grew up in a world where that kind of way of life, they don't know any different, and therefore they can't even understand what the parents are saying. Okay, I'll try and make it painfully clear to you, but that's the idea. Now, how does that affect the Jewish world? It affects the Jewish world as follows. Now, you're going to respond to what I'm going to say now very differently depending on your age group. Okay? Radically different, different depending on your age group. If you are in the 50-year-old plus, it'll be clear to you what I'm saying. And as your age is less than that, it depends, you might be ambivalent, depends on which side of the line you'll fall. But I'm going to try and, for simplicity's sake, draw it out as clearly as possible. If you fall into the 50-year-old plus age group, certainly 60-year-old age plus, most of our grandparents' generation, most of our parents' generation, generally speaking, you grew up in a world, what I want to try and describe to you, very, very briefly, is the difference between the Jewish world, the Jewish home, the Jewish norm in our grandparents' generation and what that world is now for a youngster growing up. And what I want to get across is that if you're in that older category, you cannot understand the mindset of this generation. There's no way you'll be able to understand it. And it's a credit to you. It's because of your depth of normality and dignity and Jewish values, that's the irony of it, that you can't understand the emptiness and the breakdown of this generation. Now stay with me and understand. Our grandparents were the kind of people where they came to this country and they lost all formal connection with orthodoxy. That means Torah learning and observance of mitzvahs, those two things fell out of the bottom of their world. They no longer were flamingly committed to Torah learning as an end in itself. They didn't even know what it was anymore. And Torah observance, Shabbos, mitzvah observance, dropped out of the bottom of their world. But, and this is the important thing to grasp, what they remained as human beings was incomparably greater than what this generation is. They, our grandparents, right, even if they did not observe any formal Torah observance, right, and they see the young generation now as being taking on the externality of observance, they're trying to follow rules blindly, they don't have any content. They were people who had plenty of content. I always say that a youngster in this generation who spends 20 years in yeshiva working on himself and trying to elevate his personality to a level of greatness and dignity still won't approach what his ordinary grandparents were in Johannesburg 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago with no work on themselves. Because the norm of that generation was a deep sense of self-worth, of dignity. And if you check it out for yourself, we don't have the time. Excuse me, the time to go through it, you'll find the details to be true. It was a generation where there was a sense of dress, there was a sense of chastity, there was a sense of grace in the world. If you went out on a date in that generation, I'm not saying what happened was kosher. It wasn't kosher by Torah terms. But at least it had a sense of dignity, a sense of grace. If you went to a party, you had a dance with the hostess. Young people don't understand what that means. You had a dance with the hostess. If there was a woman present who didn't have a partner, you all had a dance with her. You had to know how to dance. That's where it started. You had to have some sort of center. Today, now I'm serious about this, I still remember, I admit to you, I still grew up not going to divulge my age, but I still grew up in a generation where I became, around Bar Mitzvah, I remember asking my mother to teach me. She had a waltz around her bedroom with me, teaching me the difference between a waltz and a foxtrot, because I was ashamed to think that I'd have to enter society and I wouldn't be able to do those essential things. Fortunately, in the Torah world, fortunately for me, you don't have to do those things. But there was a set, you had to know how to do those things. There was a little bit of style that was required, a little bit of grace. You had to be a little bit, it was an asset if you were witty. If you could, today, if you spend 6 hours in the gym trying to look like a gorilla, then you're fine. A young man these days, if that's the way he doesn't have to, dance is the last thing he has to know about. Grace doesn't come into it. It just has to have muscle everywhere, between his ears, everywhere else, as long as he's got muscle. That's a very, very physical generation. And those ideas of grace and style just don't exist anymore. But more important than that, is that those people had a sense of dignity and Jewish values and human worth that was incomparable. Your grandparents, I don't care what your age is, your grandparents, if they said anything in business, they meant it 100% and they never, ever broke their word. They never broke it. If they said something socially, I don't remember my parents or any of their contemporaries ever breaking an arrangement. You know what that means? A young person today can't begin to understand what that means. They never let anyone down. If they said they would do a thing, they did their thing. You didn't need signatures and contracts. Today, with all the signatures and contracts in the world, still doesn't mean anything. Because nobody means what they say in the beginning, from the beginning. But in that generation, your word was absolutely and totally your bond. The concept of loyalty, of responsibility, their world revolved around the concept of responsibility. Now, in marriage, for example. In marriage, divorce was very, very uncommon. It was a great rarity, divorce in your grandparents. Even in marriages that weren't happy. Believe me, there were many marriages that weren't happy at all. The sparkle had gone out of the marriage long before. But divorce was something that they never would do. You committed yourself to this person. You stood under the chuppah and you declared that you'd be with this person for the rest of your life. And you meant it. And you stuck with it. Here's waltz off after 3 months. That's what's happening now. I see. Do you know that the divorce rate in Johannesburg now among young people is more than 50%? In good old-fashioned conservative Johannesburg, well over 50%. And many people divorce more than once. And with young children, I was found last week by a girl with a three-month-old baby who hasn't left. And these people are people who've been married, in the cases that I deal with, for 3 months, 2 years, 3 years, and they lived together for 5 years successfully before getting married. They lived together. Not just intimately, they set up a home together for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. The last case I was involved with was a girl who lived with a young man for 12 years. Then she started mentioning marriage. She disappeared. That's another tragedy we have to talk about. That's what this generation is all about. But they lived together before marriage, and they're ending up in divorce. That means your chances of your child in a secular world ending up in a marriage that just stays together, never mind happy, are less than 1 in 2. Huh? In that generation, it didn't happen. Intermarriage. The concept of loyalty to Judaism. Intermarriage was scandalous, very rare. Divorce was very rare. All forms of social breakdown, of personal breakdown. Suicide. The suicide rate. Do you know that suicide is not uncommon now in the Jewish community among youngsters? It was very uncommon then. There was a sense of loyalty and responsibility that was the underpinning of a Jewish family. Today, unfortunately, if you have a Jewish home in Johannesburg today, not religious, and your marriage is basically intact and your children are basically normal, you are very, very lucky. There's hardly a home. If you don't understand what I'm saying, you're very lucky. If you can't see it, if you don't know it, you're extremely fortunate. But if you look around you, you'll see there is hardly a home. In good, old-fashioned South African society, Jewish society now, there's hardly a home where somebody isn't dead, in one way or another. There isn't a strained relationship going on between the child and a non-Jew, or somebody unsuitable. There isn't somebody who's mentally unwell, or some strange and bizarre tragedy that's happened or happening in the family, and often many of them together. Unfortunately, that is the situation right now. That was a great rarity in that generation. Am I making the picture clear? Are you with me? You don't have to agree with me, you just have to see the way I see it. Okay. Now, what it results in is the following thing. Okay, we could go on and on about this, but that's what it amounts to. So what you have now is the following thing. I'll give you a classical application of this. You have parents where the youngster becomes involved in a Torah observant way of life. So the first thing the parents say is, why do you need this? Because we turned out decent without it. Why do you need all this formalized ritual? Why do you need all this running around with external kind of observance that you know, everything, every little detail is so important to you? Why do you need all this? So the youngster usually says, because that's the way to turn out as a decent human being. That's the way to build myself into a right, living, dignified, loyal, and noble, aspiring human being. The parent says, but we turned out like without all this stuff. And they're right. What can you say? They're right about it. But the reason they're right is because they were brought up in a way where that was the norm. where you were expected to turn out noble and dignified and not let people down, etc., etc., etc. That was the way the world was. And they are quite right. There's nothing. Youngsters have to understand that they can't turn around to their parents and accuse them of not being normal because they're not Torah observant. On the contrary, the parents are much more Torah observant in that way. They're much more normal. They have much deeper sense of Jewish values, and of human values than the youngsters do. But what they can't understand is there's no way the youngsters will ever get to that unless they do it in a formalized structure. That's the important thing that they have to understand. Nobody in this generation, it's a very, very unusual event for a teenager these days to turn out with any of the values, any of the set of values that the parents had without formalizing it and without having to aspire to it in a formal way and try to develop it. That's why it's necessary for this generation. Add to this, I'm not going to make this too painful, but to add to this the fact that if you're over age 50, you almost certainly have no idea what's going on with the youngsters today. You have no idea. When you were living through the 60s, you kind of knew what was going on. You thought it was maybe cool and maybe hip, and it wasn't maybe for you, but you sort of more or less... But today, what's become the norm, you have no idea. If you're over age 40 right now, then what was the coolest and the most mod and the most in type of behavior, which took place on campuses back then, on the university age level of campus, even though you yourself, I'm not being personal, but let's say in general, you might have engaged in such activity or behavior on campus, but you certainly wouldn't marry a girl who had. Right? That was the standard, because there was still a concept of chastity and what it meant. You might yourself engage, and I'll share with you some stories without being too graphic about it. But that's what had happened. Today, that is what the 11 and 12-year-olds are experiencing. And if you're shocked and you doubt me, you go check it out. I've been involved directly and indirectly with cases. The youth are getting involved at that level. And not only the youth, but there are youngsters who are now of marriageable age who've grown up that way. I remember being indirectly associated with the case of a child at King David, a child in primary school at King David, who was going through psychological trauma. And they sent the child for counseling, and it turned out that the child was going through trauma because they couldn't bring friends home. This child felt ostracized because this child... Why couldn't the child bring friends home? Because the mother was walking around without her clothes on at home with her boyfriend. Okay, her mother, who was divorced, was walking around in front of the child and was hip about it and cool about it and believed the child should experience these kind of things. And the child, a primary school child, Jewish, kosher, beautiful Jewish child, felt he couldn't bring home friends to such a child. You got people already at marriage age where that's the style and that's what goes and that's the behavior. Now, that what has to be understood clearly is this enormous, enormous gap between that generation and this. And that's my first line of answer, if you like, or explanation or discussion to a parent who says to me or says to a child, why do you need this? We turned out decent. You're quite right. You're quite right. Chances are your child will never turn out as decent as you. Chances are your child, with all his effort in yeshiva and musa and working on himself and self-denial and so forth, will never turn out as normal. His marriage will never have the depth to it that yours had. His sense of loyalty and his sense of responsibility will never amount to what yours did. It's quite right. It's quite right. But the only hope he has these days is if he formalizes it in that way. And that's, I say to parents who are not observant, who object to their children becoming observant, I say, this is my personal attitude, I say the following thing. If you have any sense, you'll encourage your child to become as religious as possible, even if you are totally unconvinced about the spiritual world. Even if you personally don't hold that there's any validity in a transcendent reality and a metaphysical world and spirituality and the next world and so forth, even if you yourself are totally unconvinced about such a thing, you should encourage your child to become as observant as possible, because it's about the only chance you have these days that he'll turn out halfway normal, that he'll get married, that he'll get married in the first place, as opposed to just living with somebody on and on and on, that he'll have children. There are many youngsters getting married now who don't have children. They feel, why should we bring children into a world such as this? Whether you agree with the philosophy or not, if you're a good enough, if you're old enough, old-fashioned enough person, and you feel like you want grandchildren, or you might get to that stage, about your only chance these days, if you don't want your child sterilized or who knows what. I mean, what can I tell you? I've got a friend. I have a personal friend who married a woman who was divorced. This woman has a child of four. After the marriage, it turned out that she'd been sterilized. Because after she had the child, she and her husband decided. Can you imagine the evil of a gynecologist? Could you imagine the evil of a gynecologist who would allow himself, after a woman has had one child in her 20s, but knowing that the divorce rate, they live in a certain area where the divorce rate now is 2 out of 3. Okay? So happened, Southern California. South African boy went to marry an American girl. This gynecologist sterilized this girl because she and her husband so decided, and now she got married and she's sterilized. She's trying to reverse it unsuccessfully. Okay? As it happens, I got divorced 3 years later also. Now, that's what's going on in this generation. You can't rely on this generation. Again, I don't want to overdo this, but you have to understand it. You can't rely on this generation to even have common sense. The youth of this generation don't even have common sense. They've grown up with all the practical realities. Not like the grandparents who slaved and labored for it and were forced into common sense and normality and structure and decency and hardworking ethic. These people of this generation haven't experienced that. They've grown up with all the materialism. I'm referring now to the South African situation. They've grown up with all the material and everything you need. They've had time, instead of becoming hardworking and having to fend for themselves, they have had time to get into all sorts of crazy things. And they don't even have common sense anymore. They can't even see where it's going. If you look at the choice of marriage, you know, parents have spoken to me in heartbreak about the potential marriage partner, even where the child is thinking of getting married, that the child chooses. Because a Jewish way of doing it is you go about it with common sense. You analyze, you assess whether the person you're thinking of marrying, I mean, it's only common sense, makes sense. Is the person basically healthy? Is the family basically normal? Is the person basically mentally healthy? I mean, these are the things you ask in a shidduch type system, strange as it may sound to some, that there's such a system still. But these are the kind of questions you ask before you get involved with the person. Why go and get involved in a situation that from the start has a whole set of problems? I mean, it makes a lot of sense to approach things that way. And you discuss before you get married the basic outlook of both parties in life before you get married. But this generation doesn't do it that way. This generation, the way it happens this generation is that he's strolling across the campus lawn and across his field of vision walks somebody who looks like she's about to take a bath. So he gets attracted by that aspect of the relationship. That's exactly the way it works because that element of dignity is lost. And so that's what happens. The whole relationship begins on that footing. The orthodox way of doing things, although it sounds strange to this generation, but it makes so much sense. A woman, for example, the shidduch system. You go out with a woman. First of all, there's no concept of using, of anyone using anyone else. There can be no taking advantage. There's no physical contact allowed before marriage. And a woman has to dress in a very modest way. That's Jewish law. But she has to dress in a very feminine way because it's forbidden for her to wear man's clothing. So you have a unique situation. There's a young man who goes out with a woman. She looks very feminine and attractive because she has to according to Jewish law. But she doesn't look provocative. And he can't engage his mind. He can't engage himself in that level. So he has to talk to her. That's a very feminist idea. He has to discover who this human being. This ancient medieval primitive system that we're used to thinking about is actually a very feminist ideal. Because this young man has to think about who this woman is as a human being. He can't resort to the physical side of the relationship. By the way, it continues in marriage. Because during the menstrual separation phase, cycle, the laws of menstrual separation, there's a time in the month where you have to actually speak to her. Which is remarkable. So that aspect of the relationship is deeper, and people don't do that anymore. People don't do that. The young people don't do that. So you have a fantastic system. You have a system where you objectively and logically look at a human being in terms of the totality of what marriage means. Not the way it happens out there. But what happens out there is that a person gets involved at a party or in some non-serious thing, and then it becomes more serious and emotions get involved, and you end up in a situation where there's a torment and a tragedy in the family. Not even common sense is left anymore. There's many reasons, but that's the fact. Now, that humbly, my humble opinion is the way the background exists to this problem. Okay, that's the way the two sides of the conflict see it, and neither can explain it to the other. When the youth tries to explain, the young person tries to explain to the parents that you need to be this way in order to be decent, the parent quite rightly cannot see that, because they didn't need it and they are decent. And to them, what they see is a formalized, a ritualistic behavior that doesn't have any content. They don't see how it's connected to becoming a mensch in any way, and they're usually right about that, because the youngster usually is involved in the superficial level before he comes to a balance and actually achieves any real personality development in his own right. And the youngster can't really understand the parent, because they never understood it. They never grew up in a world of normality. They didn't understand a real depth of what chastity means, or of the depth of giving oneself in a marriage as a total gift. They've grown up in a world where there's no such concept, where relationships, and I'm using the sensual, sexual one just as an example, but you'll see it all over in business, in friendship, you'll see it everywhere. But they've grown up in a world where the relationship is as cheap as it could be, where the in thing, a girl today, a 13, 14, certainly 15, certainly campus age young girl today, who tries to maintain any sense of saving herself as a intense gift that she'll give herself in marriage, it will be an explosion of a commitment of a total life, one to the other and so forth, is a freak today. She doesn't have dates. She won't have dates today. And if you don't give her a supporting environment, if you don't take your daughter when she's 9 and start putting her into a supporting environment, she won't be able to withstand the pressure. And by the time she gets to a marriageable age, that the concept of the depth of a relationship will be so cheap that she won't begin to understand what it means. Certainly the male won't. Women usually maintain some sense of that despite what they've been battered into. But the men definitely, young men definitely won't do that. And so you have one tragedy after another. Common syndrome, again, I'll just use this as a final example, is which didn't happen in the old days. Couple got serious, the parents were demanding. You know, you've been seeing each other already for a long time, you know, 3.5 weeks. Are you going to consider marriage? You know, you had to be serious about each other. There was a demand about that. There was a limitation on the time you spent together privately and so on. Today, the couple has spent 3 years together, 4, 5 years together, and living together intimately. They set up a home. There's nothing the parents can say about it, even if they think that what they feel about it is not just old-fashioned, but it's right. Even if they feel right about it, there's nothing they can say about it. So what happens? You know what happens? You know what young women have let themselves be bludgeoned into? They now set up a relationship with a man because they need the closeness and the contact with a man, and because there's no other way to do it, because they're not ready to speak about marriage. It's just not the in thing. What young man wants to get married? So they live together, and after a certain amount of time where she's given herself entirely and she understands that this is a lifetime commitment and that's what she wants in the relationship, but he never understood that. So after 2 years or 3 years she starts mentioning marriage, he starts to get very anxious. Often he disappears, or often a tremendous tension creeps into the relationship. And it's the lucky ones who eventually end up getting married after that period of time. But what's in a young man's mind when he has to consider marrying a girl that he's been living with for the last 4 years? What on earth does he stand to gain? He right now has all the privileges of marriage without any of the obligations. So why on earth should he marry this girl? But women have allowed themselves into that situation where they have nothing left to bargain with. They have nothing left in terms of their own, but given everything away. So what happens is they're on the losing end, and they start getting into anxiety, and they start trying to maneuver in such a way that eventually they'll end up in marriage. And what happens is, of course, two things happen. Either he leaves, as a case I mentioned to you that I was connected with recently, after 12 years, she's now 29, now 29 years old, she gave herself totally to this young man when she was 18, a beautiful, unusual girl, now 29, having a lot of trouble, because he disappeared, he didn't think about marriage, a modern world, I mean, marriage. It was fun while it lasted, you know, that's what's in. Or, if he doesn't, he gets married for whatever reason, and the moment he gets married, he feels, what have I done? He feels locked into a relationship. I'll tell you a secret, an intimate secret, is that in many of these relationships, a strange thing happens. A couple live together for 2 years or 3 years or 4 years. During that time, he never even has an ordeal with another woman. Do you know that? Even though it's in and it goes and there's no reason why it shouldn't happen, in most of the cases that I've been connected with, there was no unfaithful relationship during that time. There wasn't even an ordeal. But from the first week of marriage, the husband starts to have an ordeal with other women, and he starts to feel that this is the wrong woman, and the whole thing's wrong and crazy and boring, and what did he see? And he starts to feel locked in, and the whole thing becomes a tragedy. And then there's all kinds of things that happen. One of the norms these days is that he pressures his wife into becoming a bit kinky. That's what happens. I deal with this kind of thing. Sometimes it involves wife swapping parties and other things, and the woman goes along with it for various reasons. And the next thing that ends is a relationship outside the marriage. That's what happens, usually with a husband. That's what happens. That's become the norm now. You don't have to believe me, but that's a fact. Now, that is the experience that's happening now. So, there's no way out of it. There's no way out of it. Why does a man's mind work that way? Why is it that he was faithful and had no problem and felt fantastic and never questioned the relationship before he was married? And 1 week, I've had problems with people coming to me. First week of marriage in trauma. Because he didn't have to stay. So when he wasn't locked into it, he felt free and everything was fine. The woman satisfied him in every way. But after he's locked into it, it becomes oppression, it becomes a tragedy. We have to discuss the subject separately under the heading of marriage. We did that last year, and in this session we can do it again. We have to discuss marriage in depth, because there's such misconceptions in marriage that it's almost impossible to be happy in marriage now, unless you're seriously working on yourself and you understand the subject. That's enough about that. Let me touch on one or two other angles, and we'll leave time then for questions. Okay, I think I've almost spoken enough. Some of the classical syndromes that families experience. That's the background, okay? That's the background, the way I see it. That's the what leads to the situation, what leads often to a gap of understanding. That's the way I see it. Maybe wrong, that's the way I perceive it. What actually happens? What are the mechanisms and what can you do to avoid the pitfalls? There's much too much to discuss here. Let's just go through some of the classics, and which might be all too familiar or painful. Involved is for another reason that causes a gap between parents and child, and that is because this generation is interested in mysticism. take it or leave it. This generation, the youngsters, the teenagers, the university, young adult age, is interested in a transcendent experience. They're interested in the mystical. They want to know about it. They accept it as something real. The older generation, the grandparents' generation, is not interested in a mystical experience. They don't understand it. They don't have a place to put it. They will not come to a shiur on the mystical experience. If you advertise a shiur on meditational Kabbalah, that, you will not find anybody over age, whatever it is over there. The grandparents do not come. They're not interested in meditating in a Kabbalistic fashion. They're not interested. But the youngsters, the campus age, are all fascinated by that thing. And that's another reason, another element of personality variance between the older and younger generation, that they can't understand the youngsters. They think that this person sailing off into who knows what kind of imaginary world of mystical experience, and when the child tries to convince the parents, of course it sounds horrific, and if the parent's exposed to any of it and picks up secretly a book that he would never admit to the child that he even looked at while the child's out of the house, the stuff is horrific. The kind of material you read over there doesn't begin to make any sense, especially to anybody, I'll admit, I'll tell you. But to somebody of that generation, well, it certainly doesn't make any sense. And this generation interests. By the way, in religious homes, it's fascinating. You don't find a gap. Don't find a gap. You have problems. In religious homes, you need a lot of tears and tehillim. In the best home, you need a lot of tears and a lot of tehillim and a lot of davening that a child should turn out normal. You need it in the best home. But generally, if you can generalize, you don't find a gap. You don't find that the child is trying to do something without the parent knowing because his in-group is doing that and the parents disapprove. You just don't find that. The models, the roles, what they admire are the same. What the parents admire and what the youth, on the contrary, the youth usually admire it more because they got the fire of youth. The parents sometimes feel maybe that their chance to achieve that greatness is over. But there's no gap. But when the child gets fired up about the Jewish thing, it's a remarkable, beautiful thing to see. But that's the experience. So the child gets involved, the youngster gets involved, he's interested in something mystical. Often it happens in a marriage. I just haven't been able to deal with marriage as well, but you'll understand, it often happens. Often it's the woman. Often it's the wife who's sensitive to a deeper element. She understands something about the mystical world, what it means in terms of relationships and the depth of what a man is to what a woman is. The husband isn't interested. He's a more logical type of personality, or he's a more practical type of personality in certain ways. He isn't involved. That causes a rift between them. That's what happens. When the youngster starts to get involved, then you enter a phase of tremendous conflict. And usually the cause of the conflict is the fault of the young person. Why? Because he becomes extreme in non-essential areas. He doesn't, rightly and wrongly, wrongly, because he doesn't think about what he's doing to his parents. So he starts demanding that the mother does this and this and this in the kitchen, all of it unnecessary. All of it unnecessary. Right? But he doesn't understand. He thinks he's got to take everything to extremes. He battles against the resistance of his parents by becoming more extreme. Right? And not only that, but the tragedy and the irony of the situation is that if you're halakhically knowledgeable, you can maneuver in almost any situation. If you are halakhically knowledgeable, if you've been involved for 20 years, you could eat in your parents' home, even if they're totally unkosher, if you knew what you were doing. If the food is cold and it wasn't cooked in a certain way, and you can get by with virtually, you can basically get by with eating in your parents' home if you know what you're doing. But what happens is the youngster doesn't know what he's doing, so he imagines everything is more serious than it really is. And he doesn't know the difference between a mitzvah and a chumrah. A chumrah is a non-essential stringency that people on a very great level take on. So the youngster comes home blurting out stuff about Chalav Yisrael and about Bishul Akum and Yoshon and who knows what these kind of chumras are. Parents never heard of them. Parents grew up sometimes in very orthodox homes. Sometimes the parents grew up in very orthodox homes. Very orthodox. The parents might have been very orthodox figures in the grandparents' generation, and they never saw any of this stuff. And here the child is going crazy with accusing his mother for not wearing a shaitel and he suddenly won't kiss Aunt Daisy, and he won't, and you end up with a situation where the youngster presents to his parents the most bizarre picture you can imagine. Okay, he won't stay at home with a maid because the Isra of Yichud. You're not allowed to be locked in a place together. It's the Isra of Yichud. A Jewish man is not allowed to be in a locked up situation where the woman is forbidden to him. So when his mother goes out, he suddenly screams across the house in a panic and unlocks the front door. So his parents think that he's a security threat. What can I tell you? And he goes on explaining to them about Mabel in the kitchen, who's an Isra Yichud with him. And then his mother cooks him the most special meal. It comes home from yeshiva, this poor, staring-eyed, fanatically inspired youngster. His parents have very serious doubts about his sanity. Comes from yeshiva. His mother personally cooked him the most fantastic meal. And did she check it out? She spoke to this rabbi and that rabbi, and it's Yoshon and Chalav Yisrael, and it's been checked, and it's been this and that and other. He won't eat it. Why? Because she didn't switch on the stove. Because Mabel switched on the stove. Right? And it's Mishal Akum. Okay? This is what happens. Okay? Of course, the paradox and the irony of the situation is that the youngster, while he's keeping all these extremisms, is trampling, as I said, on Kibud Av V'Aim, which is one of the Ten Commandments. He had just smashed his parents' happiness, often an element of the marriage. He also made a Chilul Hashem, because now his parents think little, they belittle, they think lowly of Orthodox Judaism. They think that he's been influenced by rabbis who are irresponsible and don't understand the essential, and so forth and so on. And therefore, you often have, as I've described to you, a thing. The youngsters are insensitive, they don't know how to handle the situation, they don't have the right guidance, they take on stringencies. The parents force them into being more strict than they have to be, because what happens is the parent tries to needle all the time. What usually happens in a situation is the parent comes with very bitter complaints against the child. You're breaking up the family. Here's this child who's trying to show his parents that out of the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Aim, he loves them intensely, and he's trying to show in every way that he loves them much more than he would have before. And by the way, it's true. Because if your child doesn't get involved in a religious way of life, he'll kick you in the teeth in the end. That's the norm these days. Kick you in the teeth, forget about you, and disappear. But a child who becomes religious these days has a tremendous conscience about hurting you, and is trying to express the love. And you, the parents, they accuse the child of splitting up the family and causing distance. It's a knife in the heart that a child can't take that. So the child tries to achieve more closeness, and the parent tries to modify the child's behavior. As the child becomes more extreme, so it seems to the parent in observance, so the parent tries to say, but you know, please eat this gefilte fish. I made it for you, and it's okay. And the child knows it's not okay. So the parent wants that the child is caught in a conflict. Right? There's a way to handle that situation, by the way. I'll try and get back to that in a minute. There's a way to handle this to ease the tension of these extreme conflicts. Then the child thinks mistakenly, terribly mistakenly, I don't mean child, I mean the younger person, that if he just is totally true to his Torah ideals, then the parent will see all the nobility and dignity of it, that he follows his Rebbe, right? And the greatness of his Rebbe, who's a transcendent personality and can make things levitate and who knows what it is, he will speak, his Rebbe knows everything, and he thinks that the parent will sort of get a vibe of that. Well, the parent doesn't get a vibe of that. What happened, the last case I can think of was a young man who was in Yeshiva in Jerusalem. His father came to fetch him. His father came from Cape Town to fetch him home, because the boy was going crazy. The boy was taking it to extremes. He was not handling it as he should have been. Instead of writing letters home to his parents about how are you and I played baseball on Friday, he wrote long droshes to his parents. Lengthy droshes. While he'd been traveling Europe the year before, they never heard from him. But now in Osamach, they received 10-page epistles on the meaning of creation and how one should be. That's what happened. So the parents were convinced that he'd gone nuts, and the father came to fetch him. The father was a sick man. There were tensions and problems in the family, and the father had specially come to fetch this child, and as he was about to take him home, and he booked him a ticket and so forth, the son at the last minute said, we have to ask my Rebbe. So they went, so the father went, and they sat in front of the boy's Rosh Hashiva. It was a totally mischosen Rebbe. It was a person from a different cultural background, totally didn't understand where this family was coming from, probably hadn't met a non-frum person in his life. And the Rebbe started to tell the boy what to do in front of the father. The father went absolutely crazy. He tried to strangle the Rebbe. He tried to burn down Osamach Yeshiva. That's what happened. There was another occasion with the same youngster where the boy was supposed to come home, and they were expecting him on the plane the next day, and he phoned up the day before to say he's not coming because his Rebbe told him he was staying in Yeshiva. Okay? So can you imagine the conflicts that he imagined and how unwisely they were handled? Now, before going to, there are many, many, I don't want to take all night here, there are many, many more classical syndromes, if you like, of tension in families, marriages, and so forth. Let me just share with you one or two ideas, I'm sure you'll ask about this anyway, one or two ideas about how to handle this kind of situation, okay? Obviously, some of them are obvious from what I've said. The person getting involved has to understand what's a priority and what's not a priority. He must go to a mature rabbi who understands the whole situation, and ask him, what can I eat, and what don't I eat in my parents' house, and not even mention the things where the problems aren't, but to eat normally as far as possible. It was good enough to bring you up. It was a good enough home to give you the idealism and the values that it's given you till now. So it's good enough for you to live in right now. You should make allowances in your parents' home that you don't do anywhere else. So they didn't toivel the dishes in the mikveh. So they didn't do that yet. So if you're serious about it, you do it for them. Or if you're not serious about it, so you swallow that issue and you just put up with it. Until you don't take on chumras. You don't start taking on stringencies where in other areas you're not even taking on the basics yet. And you can't possibly psych this out and work this out for yourself. You need a rabbi, you need a rebbe, somebody who's mature, understands the situation, understands where the parents are coming from, who can advise the youngster on what to do. When it gets into the intimate area of marriage, the woman wants to start going to the mikveh, and she won't allow her husband to touch her for so many days of the month. It's an enormous potential for conflict, or vice versa. And it's not in the contract. We didn't get married on the basis of that understanding. Where do you come up with this from now? And so forth and so on. That has to be understood, to be dealt with very, very, very sensitively. Okay, and it can be dealt with. Now, one or two tips, okay, about how to deal with this. I'll just share perhaps one with you. I expect that many of them should be obvious from the by virtue of the matter of discussion. I want to just say two more things. One is this. There are techniques that if you speak to people who've been through it, and there are many experts, right? In Johannesburg, we may not have the greatest Torah sages in the world. We have great people, but we have people who are certainly experienced in this area who are masters at it. And you can share, you can knock, bounce off your ideas of people who've been through it and have a depth of wisdom, maturity, and understanding in this area to be able to, and I'll share with you an example, right? An example. A classical example is where the child tries to duck and dodge without confronting the issue with the parents. And what happens is the parents then try to pressure more, the child ducks and dodges more, and you end up in a terrible mess. The way to handle it is make a clean breast of it, sit down, discuss it, they'll be ranting and raving for half an hour, but you're prepared for it and you won't let it get out of hand, and after that the lines will be clear. Okay? Examples would be, I know a family where they engaged a certain, after a number of years becoming deeply religious, they met a relation that they hadn't seen for a long time. And it was the worst kind of relation. It was the relation who feels they are kosher, but they're not. The kind of person who thinks they are observant, so they expect you to eat in your house, but actually it's not okay. Okay? It was in a certain part of the world where there's much more problems with certain kinds of kosherness than there are. So the family decided, the husband and wife, with the little children, the husband and wife decided, they won't tell this relative about exactly that they are not so happy with her standard of kashrus. What they'll do is they'll just duck and dodge and they'll make do. So what happened was they went to the person's house and they ate there, even though it wasn't okay. What did they eat? Ate a baked potato, they ate a boiled egg, they ate some rolls that were okay, and they didn't say anything. They left what wasn't okay and they ate what was okay. So the person thought that actually it was okay. So then she said to them, and I baked you a cake. And the cake was not beseder. The cake wasn't okay. The flour wasn't sifted. In that part of the world, there were many problems with that. I'm not going to go into, but there were problems. So they didn't know what to do. So they said, well, we don't feel like it now. So she says, well, I'll give it to you to take home. So they said, fantastic. So this lady, with all the trouble she'd gone through to bake this fantastic cake, she gave it to the family and the family took it home. 6 months later, she saw them again. So she said to the six-year-old child in the family, how was my cake? So the child said, what cake? So this lady said to the parents, is that what religious people do? They throw away food and they tell lies. Is that what they do? And it was a terrible Chilul Hashem. And it caused a rift in the family. Okay, that is not the way to handle the situation. The way to handle the situation is like this. Now you have to apply it to your own individual situation, right? It may not be the way for you. But generally the way to do it is to make a clean issue of it and to deal with it usually in the following way. You sit down and you say, look, mom and dad, we've got something to talk to you about, okay? This is after you've been going through years of the children calling the grandfather a goy because he doesn't wear a kippah, and the young woman ranting and raving because the grandmother bought the child an ice cream that wasn't halal Yisrael someplace, and that's what happens, okay? And the grandparents feel their grandchildren are being torn away from them, and that's often. You sit down and you say the following thing, look, mom and dad, we've got something to talk to you about. What is it? We have become fanatics, that's what you say. You say, we've become fanatics, we've gone crazy, okay? You don't have to understand this, totally flipped, we've gone crazy. From now on, this is what we do and this is what we don't do, okay? We eat this and this and this and this and this in your house because we love you so much and because of our responsibility and obligation and depth of appreciation for you. And because the only reason we've come to this aspiration in ideals and abilities is because of what you gave us, we'll make exceptions in your home. And in your home, we'll eat this and this and this, but we won't in our days, okay? We will not, in future, allow our children to do this and that and the other. I don't care whether you think it's logical or not. You want to take them to see a movie of some kind of movie or whatever it is, totally innocuous and harmless. It's bad education. We won't let them go. Don't ask questions. We will eat the following things exactly. We won't eat the following things. We will do this. We won't do this. Those are the rules. The result of that kind of approach is this. For half an hour, you have an absolute fit in the house. That's what happens. Usually, that's the norm. If you're lucky, that's what happens. The older generation often goes completely crazy, that this is all ritualistic nonsense, and that there's people making money out of giving heksherim to foods and all this, and it's so illogical and all kind of stuff. But the young generation are prepared for it, and therefore they sit there smiling pleasantly and telling the parents how much they love them. Very hard for a parent. Very hard for a parent to cope with that. That's a trick, you should remember. Even if they know it, even if they were here tonight and they heard it, it doesn't matter. When they sit there ranting and raving about what a ritualistic, brainwashed zombie you've become, and you keep telling them sincerely how much you appreciate what they've done for you and how much you love them, it takes the wind out of their sails. That's what you should do, and you should do it sincerely. You should mean it. You better appreciate it. That's what it is. And then, when that's settled down, and the dust has settled, from then on, there's no problem. Your mother won't anymore start trying to influence you subtly by saying, have this and have that and have the other. She just won't do it. She will give you what she knows you can eat, because after all, she wants is closeness with you. So she won't, and of course, you've chosen a line that's the minimum. You won't hack her about Chalav Yisrael, and about this, that, and the other. Children don't have to eat Chalav Yisrael, and even you don't have to, maybe, in your parents' house. You won't take on this and the other chumra. You'll take on the essentials. And sometimes the essentials are surprising. Parents don't know. Eating meat, let's say. That's kosher. Even though it's not the kind of meat that has all the stringencies and fussy details that you have, it's probably okay in your parents' house. But eat a piece of lettuce, right, that your mother hasn't checked properly, is 5 times worse than eating pork. Do you know that? Eating an insect that's undiscovered in salad, okay, according to Torah law, is 5 times exactly worse than eating pork. That's what the Torah says. And therefore, you have to explain these things to your parents. The parents don't know this. They think that eating pork is terrible. They understand that themselves. They may observe that law themselves. But understand that there's an invisible little insect on the back of the lettuce that you can only see against the light. They don't know. So that has to be explained. You have to be more fussy about the lettuce, much more fussy about the lettuce and about the spinach and certain other things than you have to be about the kashrus of the meat. There's no question about it. Or the plates, or what's been in the mikveh, what hasn't been in the mikveh. That's the way, very often and successfully, is handled. Another way to apply this is by forewarning and predicting situations before you drive your parents into a dive of embarrassment. Right? You follow. Let me give you an example. When the family throws a big party for you because you come back from your 3-year overseas trip, they don't know that 2 years of it was spent on Samach, becoming a fanatic. They throw this big party for you, and as you arrive at the party, Aunt Daisy charges you, right, to ensconce you in a very intimate embrace, which was perfectly acceptable before, and you start tearing around the room to escape on Daisy, while your parents die of embarrassment. That's not the way to handle the situation. The way to handle the situation is to tell your mother to phone Aunt Daisy, or you make an announcement to the family, as I did. And I'll tell you the truth. You sit down with the family and say, look, I've become a fanatic. You may think that this is all nonsense, that shaking hands with a woman or kissing an aunt or something like that is totally nonsense to observe. If you want, I'll explain it to you. I have a very, very good logical reason behind it. And I wish we had time to go into all these things this evening. And if you don't, I'll take you to somebody who can explain, or I'll provide you with the material, the books, the tapes, where if you're sincere about it, you can check it out for yourself. But that's what I observe. Once the family gets that message, they will not try to embarrass you in such a way. Sometimes you have to be cleverer than that. My wife and I have a system. I'll share it with you. Patent it. We have a system where we're forced into situations where people perhaps don't know that we've become as involved as we have, or perhaps people who don't know anything, where we try to stick together. If we're at a wedding or a reception or with a lot of people, and it's likely that somebody will try and kiss my wife, or a woman will try and shake my hand, or whatever, we stick together. And when a man puts out his hand to my wife, I shake it. Or when the woman puts out her hand to me, my wife grabs it. The people think you're nuts, but they don't feel embarrassed. Okay? Because it's a terrible thing to put out your hand to somebody and to have it not accepted. It's a great slight, and it's a thorough prohibition to offend somebody like that. I'm not saying you should shake hands. You probably shouldn't. But nevertheless, you should ask a competent halachic authority. The general attitude is that we don't. But a person feels very bad. Whereas if somebody else shakes their hand, they don't feel embarrassed. They think there's something wrong with you. But they themselves don't feel left hanging in their end in embarrassment. And you can use that kind of thing if you've got a mother who's halfway sensitive and sympathetic to your feelings. So walk around close to your mother, whatever thing it is, and whoever comes up to... your mother can take care of it. That's whatever. Now, sometimes you have to think ahead. I had an example in my own life where I had a very difficult situation. I was close many years ago with a certain woman in St. Louis, Missouri. I spent a year there. She's a very unusual woman, a very striking and unusual woman. She's a pilot. Interesting woman. In fact, she's a pilot. She flies a private plane from a landing strip that the Navy pilots who fly from the aircraft carriers will never use. It's got too dangerous. They can't get their planes in there. That's where this lady flies. That's a very unusual lady. I was very close with her in the day before I was involved in such an orthodox way of life. So I didn't see her for many years. And we had a very special relationship. She was much older than me, a very interesting woman. And so what happened was this. She came to Jerusalem. And she contacted me. We arranged to meet. And I meet her. But I knew it was going to be could you imagine? So the way I handled it was like this. I phoned her up first. I phoned her at the Jerusalem Hilton and I said, look, I'll fetch you in half an hour. She said, great. And I said, okay, but there's something you have to know. I said to her, there is a deep Jewish tradition that a man is not allowed to have any physical contact with a woman other than his wife, or mother, grandmother, daughter, granddaughter, etc., or sister. And therefore, I won't be allowed to shake hands with you or anything like that, okay? long silence. So I said to her, I assure you that it's my loss, you know, I try to be very gallant about it. But that's the fact. Okay? So there was half an hour for her to assimilate that fact, okay, before I went to meet her. And of course I handled it like a military operation. I made sure there was enough room in the lobby to escape in case she lost her cool, you know, but the fact is that it worked, okay? I had a lot of insults about it, and I took a great mental beating right through the rest of the evening, but nevertheless, I saved myself from a potential Torah prohibition. Yeah. So, forewarning, sometimes you have to predict situations that are going to happen, you have to deal with them that way, instead of getting into the situation unprepared. Okay, I think I've said enough for now. There's lots more to discuss, okay? Many, many more situations. Most of them have to be solved in a private way. Most of them have to be thrashed out along these guidelines between the two parties who are involved. Often an even more difficult situation than this is the marriage conflict situation. Also, that needs a separate discussion. People have to work out these things in detail on their own. But I think I've tried to cover a bit of an introduction to the subject, one or two specifics, point out one or two angles that maybe people don't notice. I'll conclude with just one remark, and it's as follows. This is the most heartfelt thing I can say about it. What can I tell you? If you belong to a generation, the older generation, and you don't understand what's happening to your child, or if you're even involved in a marriage where you don't understand what the other person's going through, stop and think for a moment. Apart from what you stand to gain from this thing, you stand to gain a normal child. True, the child will do strange things. They will observe rituals that you don't understand or that you don't think are necessary. But at the core of that personality is doing these strange things, which after all have been accepted for thousands of years. Some of the world's greatest people have done those things. They will be inside normal people. They will have a sense of responsibility. They will not neglect you. They'll not kick you in the teeth. They'll produce grandchildren who they'll try to get to love you. They will honor and respect you. They'll respect your point of view. They will be normal people. They will not leave their wife. The divorce rate is almost zero in the religious world. It's not zero and it's climbing, but it's almost zero. They'll have a normal warm marriage. The children will turn out halfway normal individuals. They won't turn out twisted and empty the way this generation and undisciplined like this generation. There'll be communication in the family. There are so many advantages that a parent, if they just think about it, will gain that they would never have if they let the child disappear to an ashram in Tibet or some other place. That they will have if they allow the child to go that way. They'll make a normal marriage with the right, they'll achieve some common sense, they'll develop them to an intellectual level. Even if they don't go to university, even if they leave their course at university, even if they don't pursue their profession that you've paid so much effort and time and money into giving them, they'll develop in some way intellectually. I can assure you that the intellectual development that yeshiva offers makes university pale into insignificance in terms of bringing out your potential. Very often it's a better fitting for a profession. Very often it's a better fitting for coping with life, including making a living, than certain courses at university. That's a difficult area, and I'm not one to talk about it because I did have a profession before I got involved. So it's hard for me to tell parents that they must let their children go to yeshiva before they've done their profession. That's a vexed area, have to be discussed separately also if there's time. But in addition to all that, the parents should think how lucky they are and how proud they can feel that they have a child who is somewhere inspired by some sense of nobility, while his friends are out there trying to behave like gorillas, literally. And they have no greater aspiration in life than the immediate physical needs, at best. And here they have turned out a child who wants to be a holy person, somebody who's exercising self-control, somebody to whom the important things in life mean something. What a tremendous thing to be proud of. Instead of hassling this child because he doesn't know enough about what milk or what flour or what he should eat, you should be tremendously admiring of such a young person who's prepared to engage in self-control when the rest of the world is indulging. When this person is prepared to save himself and not indulge in physical relationships and cheapen physical relationships, maybe for years on end, while the rest of the world calls him a fool. What an incredible thing to be proud of. What could be a greater asset, what could be a greater source of pride to a parent that they turn out a child who's striving for something greater in life when nobody else out there is? And the parents don't think of that, and they hassle the child, and they make them feel guilty, and they make them feel like they're medieval and backward and everything else, when this child, in fact, is an idealist. And to understand that when the child won't give in on a certain issue, it's not because they've become hard-hearted or become evil-minded, it's because it's a religious conviction. It's not like when a child takes up cycling or some other physical pursuit and the parent has a conflict with the child. In the end of the day, that's not the child's life, even though he goes through a phase where he thinks it is. But this is his life. He feels he's letting Hashem down. He's letting God down. He can't back down. When the parent says, listen, just do me a favor and come with me to this and this and this place on Shabbos, and it's so important to me. The child's not being evil-minded or unappreciative, but he's got Hashem on the other side speaking to him. Of course he has to, and he remains committed to his principles. What do you want from a child if not to remain committed to ideals and principles? You want a child who's wishy-washy and doesn't Joanna Chalden knuckles under and gives in and gives up his principles that he's dedicated his life to. That what you, of course you don't want that. You want a child that has this in, and what a great thing that your child has become attached to. Instead of becoming attached to some ashram someplace in Kathmandu, where recently a certain group of Hasidim went out to Kathmandu and they made a Pesach Seder. You know that? They made a Pesach Seder for the Jewish children who are in Nepal meditating in ashrams. And they catered for 200 people and 900 Jewish youngsters came. You know what that means? In one place in the Tibetan Himalayas. Your child hasn't become attached to that. They've become attached to the core, the center of the universe. They've done it because they feel it's true. They have a deep sense of identity with it. They've come to their roots. They've come to apply themselves to what is real and correct and deep Jewish values. That's a source of tremendous pride to a parent. Help them get through the unbalanced stage instead of making it worse. Help them, guide them, go near yourself instead of hassling them from the outside without knowing about it and being so self-assured that there is no transcendent reality. Go to a few shirim yourself. I'm speaking for the people on tape also who aren't here, because I know the people who feel so badly about it, they wouldn't come tonight. Go to a shir, check it out for yourself. Learn it from an objective source instead of from what your child is telling you. See if it makes any sense. You'll be amazed. You'll find it makes tremendous sense. It has a depth of logical and critical analytical depth behind it that you can't begin to measure up to. That's what your child becomes attached to. That is personally the way I see the situation. No one sent any questions up. You can ask a question in person with pleasure. Nobody?
How do you know when you're ready to go to yeshiva?
You're ready. Send your parents to speak to me. There's a big problem with when you're ready to go to yeshiva. The problem is not when you're ready to go emotionally or whether you become committed enough. That's irrelevant. You should go right in the beginning before you know anything, because that's the place to get it sorted out. That's not the problem. The problem is when you can realistically go in terms of the rest of your life. You have a responsibility to your parents, and therefore it's much, much better to get them to approve if you possibly can. The problem is much more, is differently accentuated for boys than it is for girls. I'll just speak very briefly about it. That if a person wants to go to yeshiva, they should try their utmost to do it with their parents' approval. I'll tell you for the record that according to Jewish law, listen carefully now, according to Jewish law, a child may not disobey their parents. Okay? You may not disobey your parents. You are obliged in Jewish law to do certain things for your parents. Among them, you may not use your parents' first name ever. May not use your parents' first name. Okay? Ever. Never mind calling them that, which is a very, very slighting and disparaging way of dealing with your parents. You may not sit in their chair. Okay? You must stand up when they walk into the room. There are things that you have to do for your parents, and Jewish youngsters who become involved will do these things. But you also may not disobey, and you may not disagree with your parents. Even if your parents say something that's wrong, you may not disagree. You have to say it in a certain way. You may not say, "Dad, you're wrong about that. You're not allowed to do that according to Torah law." You have to say, "Dad, didn't you once tell me something different? Or isn't it possibly true?" You have to phrase it in a way that is very respectful. You may not disagree. And one of the laws is that you may not disobey your parents. But there are certain exceptions. Okay? If it comes to the ultimate situation where it's your life and growing in Yiddishkeit, and that's what it comes to, a real, critical, final, do-or-die situation, then there are some things that you can disobey your parents. One of them is, I don't want to give too much ammunition over here, one of them is that if a child wishes to live in Israel, and the parent says no, when all else fails, it is one of the things. Please, you cannot act on anything I'm saying this evening. You need a competent halachic psak halacha in your particular situation. I'm not qualified for that, and you can't apply generalities to individual situations. But with the correct halachic givens, you can disobey your parents to live in Israel, certain aspects of marriage, and to go and learn Torah, for a boy anyway, you can disobey your parents even if they want you to go to university. You can go to yeshiva. But now, please, it's on record here that you cannot, this is the generality, you cannot. This is to show you the greatness of what Torah learning is. But you cannot act on this, what I'm saying tonight, unless it's paskin for you by a halachic. And it's best not to do that. Okay? The reasons are, we have to get into the whole area of whether to first train in your profession or trade, and then go to yeshiva or vice versa. If anyone's interested, I'll talk about that also. That's a critical area. For some parents, it's the biggest and main area. But when you're ready is this. Personally, you're ready immediately. You definitely should go there to a place that's got responsibility, maturity of leadership, and all the kind of things that will help you work on yourself and come to some kind of common sense, balance, and maturity as soon as possible.
and place demands on you in terms of Torah learning and intellectual development and personal development. But in terms of when it's right family-wise, you have to discuss it personally with somebody who knows, with your parents first and foremost, and then with the halachic, somebody halachically qualified. If you've got one more year to go to university and you want to give up the whole course, let's say, and go study in yeshiva, it's not so simple. Or if your parents don't want you to go, it would break their hearts, even though they're wrong. Even though they're wrong, even though what you're doing is much less important than going to yeshiva, you definitely shouldn't do that out of honor and respect and gratitude to your parents and so forth. But it's a difficult situation that has to be discussed independently. I've just mentioned one factor that people often don't understand, although there are many factors to be discussed, and that's as follows. There's just one factor that parents have to bear in mind, and that is when a youngster wants to go to yeshiva, I'm talking about a male now, boy, wants to go to yeshiva, and he has a certain amount of studying left to complete. Either he hasn't started his course, which is often a classical situation, and the parent feels that you're going to go and do the study thing, you're going to have no certificate, no qualification, no credential in your hands. How will you earn a living? Be practical. Instead of going and studying this wonderful mystical stuff, which I'd also like to do, maybe, but I've got responsibilities and you don't. That kind of attitude, which is 100% correct when parents say that. You have to know how to, what the Jewish approach is to such a subject. I just want to add one detail without going into the whole subject right now, and that detail is that what parents can't understand, and I'll tell you the truth, youngsters can't understand it either, but I understand it, is this, and you'll see why. If you've had the background of the experience, you'll know, is that if you go to yeshiva now, or 2 years later, right, let's say you've got 2 years of a course to do, so the toss-up is this: should I do my course now and then go to yeshiva? Many people ask me this question, and many others. Should I do my course now, get the qualification, complete it, or finish whatever it is I'm doing, and then go to yeshiva 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the line? Or should I first go to yeshiva, and then we'll see about the course later? Now, there's a factor that has to be made. I'm not saying you should go to yeshiva and drop the course. That's a personal question that has to be discussed in detail personally. But there's one factor that I can't emphasize strongly enough that I'll never be able to convey the depth of to you, but let it go on record, and it's as follows. A youngster who goes to yeshiva, classically at the earlier age, 18, 19, 20, listen carefully, okay? Again, I may be wrong about it. I'm not wrong, but I may be wrong about it. But this is definitely the way I see it, is this. If a youngster goes to yeshiva now, or they go to yeshiva 2 years down the line, there's no comparison that can be made between the quality of the experience, okay? Because from age 18 on, you start declining intellectually. You start hitting an exponential dive. By the time you're 25, you're finished intellectually. That's where it is. All the world's great discoveries. Einstein's great breakthrough was made when he was 16. I don't know if you know that. The rest was an elaboration, details, and so forth. But the brilliance is 1 year of greater maturity, of being more formed in your ways, of lesser intellectual potential. 1 year of that, you will cope in yeshiva, you will achieve what you should achieve, where you really need the kalim, where you really need the potential, where you really need everything you've got to succeed in yeshiva. University is a walkover compared to yeshiva. I'm serious about that. Where you really, 1 year down the line will be an incomparably lower experience and opportunity than it will be now. A year later doing your insurance course or your estate agent's course or whatever it is won't make much difference. But a year later in yeshiva will make an incomparable, infinite difference. What can I tell you? I'm trying not to exaggerate. That's the way it will be. Because when you go when you're younger, and when you go when you're less formed, and you go when you're brighter and more idealistic and have more potency to put into such a demanding experience, you will grow to the level that a year later, or 2 or 3 or 4 years later, will be incomparably low. I'm talking about the male experience now. For women, it's not necessarily the same. It's the same for other reasons, but this is what it is for me. And therefore, that has to be borne in mind. It's not just a question of be practical, finish your next 3 years, because you might as well get that certificate. That's true, the parents are 100% right about it, and I agree with it. But 3 years later, right, when you're 21, as opposed to what you could have gained, if you're going for greatness, if your child has the potential to be a great in Torah, which is the highest and the most demanding that he could be in life, and will get the maximum out of him personality-wise, and contribute the maximum to the Jewish people and to the world and to his personal life. So he won't be able to make it if he goes 3 years later than if he goes now. There's absolutely no question about it. Okay, and I can back it up with stories and experiences, my own personal, but that's, you have to know that fact. You don't have to agree with me, but that's, this question's too long, I have to come back to it just now. Try to write your thing in 3 words, okay? What's going on here? I've got a photocopy of the same question. Yeah, please ask a question. Speak up, I can listen to you while I'm reading. Here's a question from a woman whose husband is certain way along the path. He understands certain things, but she's much more committed than he is. Her question is more or less, she's lucky in that he agrees to do certain things, but her question is, how can she get him to be more involved in seeing things the way she does than he actually is, or that he's than he's prepared to agree to right now. Again, it's an endless discussion, but briefly, very briefly, okay, and those who've been attending our shiurim on a long-term basis will be familiar with some of these ideas. The only way to get a man to do anything is to make him think he thought of it himself. Okay, men, for various mystical reasons, which I'm not going to go into now, men have a certain immature streak in them. Okay, the mystics say that. I'm not saying it. The mystics say that there's a certain beauty and sparkle to a man's personality that makes him always require newness of experience, not the depth of consolidating an experience, but rather the sparkle and attraction of newness. That's always why men have an ordeal with other women, whereas a kosher Jewish woman does not have an ordeal with other men. In many other applications, that's why men never grow up. Also, the mystics say that there's a famous book by an Eastern mystic, not a Jewish mystic, in which he says that a woman is a woman, but a man is a child always. That's what it is. Men, as I've often said, are 50, are playing with the same toys they played with when they were 15. These are bigger and more expensive versions, but the same toys, basically. Women aren't like that. Why is a subject that I'm not going to go into now. If you've been coming to our shurim, or you come sometime, I'm not offended if you don't, but you must. I'm honored if you do come. We'll go through the subject again in the future and understand it more deeply. But a man has to be handled by a woman. Again, it's a tremendous generalization, but most men, unless he's really working on himself, unless he really has a Torah commitment and he's really working on his personality and self-control and humility and so forth, most men are an inflamed bundle of ego. That's what most men are. And therefore, if you tell a man, especially if you're a woman and you tell a man what to do, there's no chance that he's going to do that. And therefore, the last thing you do is tell him that he should come to shiurim, or he should start being more observant. What you should aim for with a husband is that he should come and learn, not that he should start observing. Because people who don't understand the background of Torah find it very difficult and awkward to start observing ritualistic kind of things that don't make any sense to them, quite rightly. Therefore, what a person should strive for is his lifeline to Torah, which is learning. Because that doesn't threaten him. He can sit in a shiur and he can experience wonderful ideas, and he can gain insight into a depth that he never acknowledged was there before without being threatened. If he speaks one-on-one, if he comes to speak to an individual, let's say myself or somebody else, so he feels threatened, and instead of listening to me, he's really trying to work out what he's going to answer. But if he sits in a shiur where he's not personally threatened, he can be open to things that he never saw before. So I would say the most important mitzvah to get a husband to do, again, it has to be personalized, is to start learning. Just to hear some Torah. Attach him to a shiur that's his style, that he can identify and connect with the person who's giving the shiur, and that he can start to learn something. Unfortunately, the difficulty is getting him to do it. Because if you tell him to go, definitely he won't go. How you do that? You've got to be clever about it. You've got to get some friend who goes to take him. You've got to pay him. I don't know, pay him, buy him a present. Get him a reward. Ask him to do it for your sake. Use feminine, you know, all the feminine power at your disposal. Whatever it takes, get him to do it that way. If possible, make him think that it's his idea. Don't hand him a cassette or something to listen to, or a book, right, to listen to, because he definitely won't. Leave it half hidden someplace around the house, so that when you're out, he'll definitely read it. That's the way it is. That's how, by the way, that's not only wife and husband, that's how parents, children should handle their parents also. Trying to hack your parents about the whole mystical reason for this, that, that is not going to convince them at all. But letting them hear it from some other source, if you're lucky, maybe something will get across. By the way, I forgot to mention, there's no mitzvah in the Torah for a child to makarav their parents. There's no mitzvah to get your parents involved in Judaism. It's no obligation at all. But there is an obligation to love and respect them. And therefore, you don't have any obligation. That's what parents, children's hearts break, that their parents have not yet discovered the truth about life, and that they don't know about Torah, and that they aren't experiencing the beauty of it, and what their marriage could only be, and what they could discover about the world if only they would know some of the purity and beauty of Judaism. And they can't convey it to their parents. It's a heartbreaking experience. What the children have to know is that there's no mitzvah to convey to your parents at all. The mitzvah is to love, honor, respect them, not disagree with them, etc., etc., support them, all the things that I've said, and no mitzvah to turn them on. That somebody else must do. You cannot, at least the most burning and the most urgent situation to try and convince or attract somebody to Judaism is your own family, and it's the one that's doomed to failure. Because people who've known you, an older brother who was always the one who taught you, is not going to be turned on because now you've seen the light. It just doesn't work that way, and parents certainly don't also. All right. How do you deal with the situation of family members who speak Lashon Hara, okay, especially to you? All right. What I suggest as a serious answer to this question, it's already late, I don't want to keep people longer than they can stay. What I suggest in answer to this question is this: we have promised on Sunday night to speak about Lashon Hara in detail. We are now dealing on Sunday nights. We have here in Osamach on Sunday nights, I'm only saying this because I know the people here don't usually come, so you might be interested to know. On Sunday nights here, we have a shiur which is dedicated to some of the fundamentals of Judaism, including a mystical background and a practical application, and it's more of a conversation. You know, we have questions and it's more relaxed. On Monday night, we deal with something in depth, which is much more formal. We don't have questions. Usually, that's how we deal. We have promised on Sunday night when we get to the Rambam says that people who habitually speak Lashon Hara, that means negative or disparaging things about anybody else, have no share in the world to come. It's a very, very radical statement. We promised to speak about it in detail on Sunday night. So I would suggest that if you have any connection to anybody who comes on a Sunday night, and you can pick up when we'll get to that section, it should be in a few weeks' time, we can then discuss it in detail. But what people have to understand, or what you have to understand, is that listening to Lashon Hara is a Torah prohibition that's extremely serious. In some ways, it's worse than murder. Okay, and therefore, you're not allowed to listen. What is Lashon Hara, for those who don't know? It is anything negative, even a hint or a suggestion of anything that a person wouldn't want said about him, that he said about him, even if it's 100% true. In fact, specifically when it's true. That means if you say something 100% coldly, logically, accurately about a certain person that is not complimentary, you transgress a Torah prohibition in some ways worse than murder. Okay, that's what it is. When you're in a situation and it kills three people, the one who says it, the one who hears it, and the one about whom it is said, and you are not allowed to listen to such things. You're caught in a situation where you have to listen to such things, okay, like where it's parents and you can't offend them, you have to very subtly and very carefully, you have to avoid the situation. The best way to do it is to sit down when it's not an issue, when you are affectionate and things are going well, and to explain to your parents the problem. They never heard about it. They say, but it's true. They don't understand the concept. Doesn't matter. You explain it. Bring them to a shir. Give them a book about it. There's a book called Guard Your Tongue, which explains the whole thing in fantastic detail, in brief, with practical applications, things that you'll be amazed about. You give that book to your parents to do you a favor. You explain to them, I'm not allowed to be present when you discuss personal information about somebody else, right? I'm not allowed to be present. And therefore, if they get that understanding, if they wish to speak about it, you leave the room, they won't be offended. The Gemara says your fingers are shaped like this because they fit into your ears. That's what the Gemara says. And therefore, if you're forced to, you stick your finger in your Gemara says that this piece of the ear doesn't help you hear, it helps you. You could fold it inward and block your ears when people speak things that you're not allowed to hear. And if you have to do that, you have to do that. Sometimes it's a little embarrassing, and therefore develop intense abdominal cramps and leave the room, or some other urgent reason not to be present during the conversation, and you leave. What can I tell you? But if people are speaking Lashon, if you're forced into the situation, you're locked into it, and you're absolutely forced to listen, so you have to know that you, first of all, must not in any way acquiesce or agree to the information. You must not by any sign imply that you agree in any way, and you're not allowed to believe it. You may not believe it. You may remember it and suspect it to be true, but you're not allowed to fix in your mind that it is true about such an individual, right? Even though the person telling you is reliable and so on. I can't go into a whole discussion now about Lashon Hara, but basically, it's a very difficult situation, and it's one that families don't understand. When you tell them you won't eat pork or crayfish or whatever it is, they can understand that. They may not agree, but they can understand. When you tell them that they're not allowed to say to you that so-and-so did such and such, even though it's true and everybody else knows and so forth and so on, they can't understand that. Unfortunately, I have to explain that that is Torah law. You know, I don't know if we should carry on. I don't want to keep people later than... Maybe we'll carry on a few more minutes. Maybe we can make another session out of it. Yeah, please. With friends. There's enormous area of problems experienced with friends. What I've experienced generally is that that's not as sharp or difficult an area as it is with family or husband and wife. The real truth of it is this, that if the friends are real friends, they'll stay with you. Okay? If friends are real friends and you put it across correctly to them, they will respect and admire what you're doing. If you get involved in something that's licentious, and that's involved in self-gratification and so forth, so maybe they'll think it's cool, but they're not likely to respect you for that. When you get involved in a system that's idealistic, and you're striving for ideals, and it involves self-control, and it involves all those higher things, if they're worth their salt, those friends, even if they're not yet convinced themselves to do such a thing, but they'll definitely respect your way of life if you put it across correctly. And if you remember that your main obligation there is your loyalty to them as a friend. You can't just drop people because you've seen the light differently to make a chil Hashem that way. And therefore, the way to handle friends is to retain the loyalty and declare it and show them that you love them for what they are and so forth, and put across the ideas as best you can to them to show them an understanding of why you've become involved. There inevitably is a course that people experience that the social circle changes. As they become more involved in a religious way of life, some of the friends who weren't really friends or can't handle what that means, threats to them, they feel threatened, whatever it is, sometimes they drop away. And it's a fact that the social circle changes. Sometimes you have much more painful experiences, such as the fact that sometimes your friends are doing things that are not allowed. Let's say you have a friend who's now intermarried. Let's say you have a friend, a good friend. Now you become more involved. That friend is doing something that's a Torah prohibition. They're intermarried. They married a non-Jew, let's say. And they're living happily with this non-Jew and they've got children. So there's a strong body of opinion in the Torah world that you shouldn't let your children play with children. What can I tell you? I had a Sfardi Rebbe who put it this way. He said, okay, extreme, but I'll tell it to you. You shouldn't let your children play with children of parents who don't disapprove of intermarriage. You hear that? If you know there's a family in which the parents are not against intermarriage, they think it's okay. You shouldn't let your child play with their child. You hear that? That's how far it goes. So here you've got this friend who's doing these kind of things that are terrible, and you don't want to associate with them anymore because it's a negative influence on you. You feel that you're giving approval to them by doing it, and your children are going to be influenced by that. So you have a difficult situation. Usually, the best way to handle it is totally honestly and openly. You sit down with the people and you say, like this, I'm not telling you how to live your life, okay? I've got my feelings about it. You're entitled to make your decisions. You live the way you want. Unfortunately, I have these and these and these principles. What you're doing according to the way I see the world, and I've got backup and I've got reason which can be explained to you at another time, is very wrong and negative. And therefore, it's very painful for me to see, or I think my children, whatever the issue is, speak it out openly and honestly and maintain whatever contact you can in a way that's not threatening or a problem. And people will respect you if you put it that way. Okay? They will be personally hurt. It depends on their own quality and depth of character, but they will generally respect what you do.